Mr. Madge Weinstein. Hi, this is Madge. I'm trying this in stereo. I don't know if this is a very good idea, but I'm going to try it, because what happens is when I do this in stereo, it uses up more computer space. And when I do it in mono, it gives me more space so I can make the quality higher for the audio portion of the show, which is pretty much everything, since there's nothing but audio in this show. This is Yeast Radio. I'm your hostess, Madge Weinstein. I'm reporting to you live from Miami Beach right now. Gussie and I are taking a little vacation from our vacation in Boca Raton. Actually, it's not a vacation for her in Boca Raton, because she lives in the lovely pink land of Boca. It's so pink it looks like the inside of a rather withered old woman's vagina, such as Gussie. Now, speaking of vaginas, I need to talk about an experience I had today. This is a bit difficult to talk about. Excuse me, I had some popcorn in my throat. They had this delicious 97% fat-free kettle corn at the Publix store we don't have in Chicago. Seems like a very nice store. They also have this delicious tiramisu, which I think is pretty much 100% fat. So between the two of them, I get about 50% fat, which I don't think is bad. But this fat-free kettle corn is delicious. I love the kettle corn because it's a nice taste without too many calories, so I can eat three bags instead of one. Anyway, so enough about the kettle corn. That was just explaining why I got my throat so sore. But so Gussie decided that I was a little stressed out by calling her a cunt every 5 seconds, and that I needed a nice massage. So, being the possessive older lesbian that she is, she decided to hire a man to do the massage. And I thought, oh well, you know, I could use it, whatever, even though I'm not going to probably get the tinglies from whoever this is. But so this guy came over, and he was nothing interesting to look at by any means. Not that I would like men, but he was in his 50s. He had kind of a belly, very soft spoken. He said he used to be a television, you know, one of these suppliers of camera equipment and whatnot, and he had a breakdown like everyone else on earth who's Jewish, and decided to rub people's bodies, which probably means he's a sex addict, because every massage therapist I've ever known has been a sex addict, which means they are compulsive sexually, which is abhorrent, but I don't really care because I like being rubbed. Not so much with a man. But anyway, so he puts out his big rack, his rack with a Bugs Bunny sheet, and he started rubbing me and rubbing me, and I went into this la-la land. I can't tell you, this was the best massage I ever had. I normally hate when people touch me, especially on my breasts. And this man was touching my breasts and squishing and squeezing, and I thought, I for a while I felt it was like when you smoke pot for the first time and you feel like you're in this la-la Netherland, you know, with the Alice in Wonderland, the Pinkies, the Mad Hatter and the Twinkies running around with feet, all that sort of business. So next thing I know, he's rubbing the inside of my thighs, and it's creepy because I actually enjoyed it. And then he's rubbing my thighs. I'm still halfway in La La Land, but enough in regular land to notice that, and keep in mind, I am slightly postmenopausal. I'm in my lower 50s. I don't mind telling you this, my gentle audience, because I believe that women who appreciate and worship their bodies in true goddess fashion should be proud of their age. And I'm proud that I'm in my early 50s. I'm proud that I am, because I could be dead. I could be dead a long time, So anyway, so I'm postmenopausal, big deal. I say mostly postmenopausal because I still take the hormones. You know, I still like to feel womanly once in a while, but it doesn't really do shit. I'm about as dry as the Death Valley down there. But so this brings me to my point. So he's rubbing me, this gay man who's whatever, you know, old, rubbing me. And before I know it, my vagina becomes engorged with blood. And I couldn't see it, mind you, but it felt about as red as a nice juicy steak right before you put it on the grill. It felt blood red, and I could feel my vagina throbbing with blood. And it felt tingly. And I thought to myself, Jesus, how the fuck could this happen? This certainly never happens with Gussie. You know, how could this happen? Of course, Gussie doesn't really do much. She just takes her teeth out and, you know, chews on my labia for a while, but that doesn't really, you know, whatever. But so I almost felt the juices. I think I may have even felt the juices running down there. And maybe there was a smell. I don't know. Maybe there was a smell. And the juices were pouring down, and the smell, maybe, I don't know. And I was really getting excited. I felt like an 18-year-old. And I'm thinking to myself, Christ, Madge, maybe you were straight this whole time. Maybe you were just having sex with women because you enjoy torturing yourself like your mother used to do when she'd lock you in the closet with the crayons. Oh, that was Sybil. I just love that movie. I pretend it was my life because Sybil was so hot with her little hot 18 personalities. Now, if I were Sybil, I would have sex with all those bitches. And her mother's like, I hate Sybil. You little bitch, Sybil. Get on that thing with the hooks, the button hooks, and I'm going to tear your vagina up. Oh, I used to love that so much. I'd scream to the TV, hey, Sybil's mother, why don't you pour some dishwashing detergent on there, too? Yeah, anyway, no, that's not nice. But, you know, we're all crazy on the inside. The difference is I like to talk about it. I don't know what else. Oh, I want to say I am so happy because the founder of this podcasting business, who also is a pioneer on the MTV, who I remember because I'm quite old, Adam Curry, who one of the first VJs, if not the first, I'm not sure. There was that Martha Quinn, there was him, there was another one that I think had a big afro. I'm not sure. I don't remember who was who, but not that Kurt Loder. He always annoyed me, so pompous. But the original VJs were the best. Oh, and that Paulie Shore. God, did I hate him. I mean, what the hell was that? Now, Downtown Julie Brown, I actually liked. I loved Club MTV. I loved that show. I loved the wubba, 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 goodbye, good night, God bless, whatever. That was a truly wonderful show. And I miss it, and I wish I had taped it. And I don't know if they repeated, because I haven't watched MTV in a coon's age, because they used some of my girls' footage without permission, and that's the truth. Those people are motherfuckers. What was that cunt's name? The producer from MTV, and she promised to give me the credit in all this business. And she used my face without permission. What the fuck was that bitch's name from MTV? MTV's turned into a bunch of cunts owned by Viacom, whatever. What the fuck was that whore's name? Oh, I'll find out, but I'm going to wait until I get a few more listeners so that somebody can make sure she hears about it, that fucking bitch. She was producing this show called True Life about my friend, who's a whore, the art vamp. And she was a bitch. And she comes in like, oh, I want to be your friend, which we all know is bullshit on any sort of documentary. MTV documentaries are fake, like everything else. And, you know, they made art vamp go skating with this queenie. She doesn't even skate. Because they're supposed to look like they're, you know, they tell you what to do to make it look like you're living your life, even though that's not your life. But anyway, so this bitch didn't give my girls credit because they asked for some footage. Oh, what was her name? Fuck her, that bitch. Oh, she was so skinny. But I'll tell you, the videographer with her was a hot man. I would have set him up with my cousin Billy, but he's kind of a schlump. So I didn't. And plus, he was straight. So, God, I'm trying to think of that cunt's name. Oh, my goddamn phone. That's probably Gussie wondering where I am. Just a second, please. I got to pause this. Okay, sorry, ladies and gentlemen. That was Gussie, and she's on her way back. She works at the Pathmark. She's one of those old people that you make fun of in the cashier line because she bags groceries. But she runs at the speed of a turtle, so you always end up bagging your own groceries. But I do love Gussie and her bright red hair, even though you can see her scalp. There's like five strands of hair. What was I talking about? Oh, Adam Curry. So anyway, enough of the MTV. Adam Curry's the founder of this podcasting. He has a podcast called The Daily Source Code. And it's a broadcast or a podcast that we should all aspire to, because technically it's just so professional. And, you know, when you think about it, before these tangents continue, I got to get to the point. Adam Curry promoted my Yeast radio station on his radio. Oh, goddamn fucking phone. Hold on. Oh, that was Gussie. She wants to go out to dinner in the South Beach. She wants me to dress up. And oh, my throat. I think I'm getting the allergies again. Oh, I hate when the roof of my mouth itches. This is why I can never live in Florida all year, because the goddamn allergies. Can you hear my tongue rubbing the roof of my mouth? So Adam Curry promoted my podcast, and I was so delighted. And, you know, he gave me some helpful hints, but he played me talking about, you know, my promo where I say, well, it's all about vaginal yeast and getting eaten out and hemorrhoids and shitting and all this, which is, I was just so tickled pink. Pink is Boca Raton. And I just can't say enough of how much gratitude I feel towards him. And I have a special affinity. I really enjoyed what he said the other day. You know, and in case you don't know, for the friends of mine that are listening via LiveJournal and aren't into this whole podcasting thing, maybe you're listening on the MP3 download from the LiveJournals. But his website for the podcast, I believe, is curry.com. And just look for Daily Source Code. I think he's got some other shows on there and blogs and this and that, but this is a podcast. And the day he talked about me, which is of course very important, was yesterday, the 13th of December. Now, I'm not actually going to put this on the web until tomorrow, so yesterday's really 2 days ago, or whatever you fucking listen to it. Maybe you listen to it in 2,000 years and you're some fucking anthropologist trying to figure out how the hell we, you know, what the fuck we were about with all this crap. This idiot president and how we all got dead. Now, you're probably cockroaches listening to us and, you know, fucking each other with those things on your head, those pointy things. So anyway, I'm very grateful to Adam. I'm not getting anything accomplished on the show. Now I have to get ready for Gussie. I guess we have a date, and she's bringing some friend of hers who's from England, related to some old author who of course, I can't mention because, you know, we can't mention our, you know, VIPs in on the podcast, unless they're already public figures. That's just a personal rule that I have, because not because I give a shit, but because certain people that I care about who I mention. So when I tell you I ate out Melissa's cunt, I'm not going to tell you that her name, last name is Etheridge, out of respect to her breast cancer. Anyway, oy vey me. I guess this is all I can tell you today. I know this is longer than usual. I don't know what the length is of this thing. I just talk till I got to stop. And I got to stop. So I want to tell you, thank you for listening to Yeast Radio. Now, you can also find my videos on insanefilms.com. I have some lovely videos of me cooking on LSD. On there. What else do we have? A quick way to get to my website is my live journal, which is the weblog that has these audios encoded, is merminator.com. That's merminator.com. Sort of a combination of Ethel Merman and the Terminator. Merminator. think Merminator. Merminator. If you can't remember Mermin, then you have no business listening to this show, because she's the best voice that ever crossed the stage of Broadway. And I don't want to hear anything else about it. If anybody's from Chicago, I'd like to hear from you, because it's very important to me to know that people in my neighborhood are listening. I don't know why this matters. I like to know that everybody's listening. But my email address is bloated@mac.com. I have a million email addresses. I don't know which one I have attached to these links. It's also fucked in with cyberspace. bloated@mac.com. Bloated as in I have gas and I need to shit. Or bloated as in I have a queef that needs to happen in my vagina. bloated@mac.com is the email. The link to get to my blog and weblog and this and that blog and audio plot. What's the fucking thing called? The podcast. Merminator.com. Merminator. Think of Arnold Schwarzenegger with his head chopped off and Ethel Merman's in its place. That's a Merminator. Not a Terminator, but a Merminator. Merminator.com. This is Madge Weinstein signing out of Yeast Radio on location from Miami Beach. Bitch.
Bonjour, vous êtes sur la messagerie France Télécom du 0144.
Oh, now he's calling.
Votre correspondant est déjà en ligne. Veuillez laisser un message après le
beep. Somebody's calling my cellular. This is getting too much now. Maybe I'll edit some of this shit out. This is ridiculous. I shouldn't do this. People from the radio, I should give better. Let's try this bonjour shit again. Don't give me that bonjour.
Hello.
Listen, I got a recording. It said bonjour and all this shit. How am I supposed to speak French? Doesn't that recording know I'm not in France?
Everyone should be able to speak French.
Well, listen, you know, this is America. We're not allowed to say France. I think I get to go to Guantanamo now because of you and that lady.
French is the language of diplomacy. French is the language of love. If America spoke more French, they wouldn't find themselves in the problems that they find themselves in.
How so?
The American language is very... you know what Charles V said? He said that his he spoke French to his mistress, he spoke German to his dog, and he spoke English and American to his horse.
I heard the same joke when I lived in Holland, but it was that he spoke Dutch to his horse. Just insert Germanic language here, I guess.
Yes, well, anyway, I mean...
Right. So I'm recording the show now, and here's how it works. What recording is, I've had a massively fucked up show, but I don't have time to redo it, so we're just going to deal with it. I took a huge dump this morning. I shat probably 20 pounds of bloat, and then...
Oh, that's fantastic.
And then my dog...
That's fantastic news. We all rejoice.
Now, how does this figure into your economic world? Do you have to like, get out your visor with the green tint and then take a pencil and figure some shit out and tell me how this affects... Karma?
No, you're purging yourself of all of your misperceptions and preconceptions that you no longer need.
But I can get biodiesel out of that or something and affect.
You could sell it to some biodiesel gas stations, perhaps, and they could convert that into some kind of energy producing substance, I would imagine.
Oh, sounds wonderful. So here's how it works. So I'm 13 minutes into the show. I got to fill 23 minutes for Sirius, and then I go, which means about 10 more minutes, and then I'm gonna. Then we can keep talking, and that'll just stay on Yeast Radio for the rest of it. So I'll tell you when I have to. I'll do like some nice little wrap up, and then we'll just keep talking after that if you want.
Yeah. Okay. So, fine.
So you are the co-host, right, of Karma Bank, you and Stacey. And you,
that's right. And Stacey and I co-host the Karma Bank radio blog spot.
Can you explain what it is? Because I sure as hell can't. But I, please do.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, there's four basic, I guess, steps, if you will. I mean, the first thing to consider is that we are working, in effect, or Karma Bank is working for the ecology. You know, we take the position that the ecology is our client, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
Then the next thing we consider is that the ecological problems that are developing are caused by corporations for the most part, and that corporations survive on their cash flow. So the question is, how can you cut the corporations off from their cash flow and in so doing cut down their ability to destroy the environment? And the Karma Bank has figured out a way to do this that doesn't cost anybody any money. And on the show, we talk about economic issues, and we talk about these corporations, and we talk about the damage that's being done. But we also try to get to as many people as possible who can participate in this Karma Bank methodology, which doesn't require any money whatsoever, but is a way to deprive these corporations of their vital cash flow and thus take away their ability to destroy the environment, which is, per Sir David King, the science advisor in the UK, Tony Blair's chief science advisor, the biggest problem, the biggest threat in the world today. Much, much more of a threat than any so-called terrorist threat, according to Sir David King, is the environmental threat.
Well, and so I think even the Pentagon has said the same thing, I believe, right?
That's right. The Pentagon has also said that as well. So, this is a way to address this problem that is, I think, it uses kind of banking techniques in a way that have never been used before. And it takes advantage of a couple of quirks in the system.
Okay.
That can be exploited by the average listener to your show or our show to, in effect, empower themselves, or what we like to say, it's a way to monetize your dissent, to put it in economic terms.
How do you do that?
Okay. Well, the way it works is that we have figured out that different corporations have a different vulnerability to the free voice of dissent, the choice, the free, low-cost, activist method, which is the boycott. The boycott effectively doesn't cost you anything.
Right.
But the boycott needs to be brought into the 21st century. So what we did was we look at all these different companies and we figure out which company is actually the most impacted by a boycott. And by this we mean the stock price itself. If it's trading at a very high multiple to the amount of business that the company does, then if you were to boycott that particular company, you're having a greater impact on that company than if you were to choose a company that has a lower ratio.
And how do you find out which stock prices are most in line with consumer demand? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, we take the data, which is the price over sales ratio, which is available, easily gotten. Uh-huh. But the idea is, if you get enough people to think in this manner, see, it's a two-tier process. If you get enough people to think in this way, that they're going to boycott strategically, what we're hoping to do is to create a situation which I guess you could call hedge fund bait. Okay, now I know, hopefully we can get through all these terms, but this is nevertheless.
You lost me there. You want me to masturbate?
No. This is hedge fund bait.
Okay.
Which is, in other words, a hedge fund is a fund that's they're mercenaries. They're mercenaries in the market, and they look for anything, any way to make a dollar, they'll do it. They have no allegiance to any company, any country, or anyone. They're not regulated, really, in any way.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's probably a bit of a problem, but for the purposes of you can get these hedge funds effectively, if you come to them with the right kind of boycott or bait, they will attack the stock of these companies for you. They will attack the company's stock for you by making all of these negative bets on a company's stock, because they know that you're boycotting the company, you're depriving the company of its revenues, and therefore they will go ahead and start making negative bets against the company, attacking the company's stock effectively.
Oh, I see. So it's more than just a PR thing. This is actually affecting the companies. This is actually affecting the economics of each of the companies that do environmental damage. Is that right?
It's part of the financial system. You're putting everyone who's concerned about the environment, you're putting their concern into the economy.
Now, how does this hedge fund, I don't understand how a hedge fund, I mean, I understand what you're saying it does, but how does it work? Like, how do you make a bet against a company? I mean, are there, I didn't realize you could do that. I mean, it sounds like a racetrack. I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, there's two ways you can do it. One way is you simply you buy what's an option, a put option.
Uh-huh.
It's an option contract. It is like a bet. It's like you're going into the casino. You know, the Globe is one big, huge financial casino, and people are making bets all day long in one way or another, and you can make a bet on the stock going down. So you make you buy a put option, and if the stock price goes down, the value of your option goes up.
Uh-huh.
So this is just like you were betting against a sports bet, and you were betting against the team winning. You can make those types of bets. I mean, Chicago, right? The White Sox just won the World Series, right?
Right.
Now, there are people who are betting against the White Sox.
Yeah.
Now, they call their bookie.
Yeah.
And they say, we're going to bet against the White Sox. Now, those people lost their money because the White Sox won. Now, but they could, if the White Sox had lost, they would have made their money. Same thing in financial markets. You can make a bet that Coca-Cola stock is going to go down. You call your bookie, or in this case, your broker, and you make that bet. You say, I want to make a bet that Coke stock is going to go down. Your bookie/broker accepts that bet. And, of course, Chicago is the world center for the options market. You know, the Chicago Board of Options Exchange is the biggest options exchange in the world. So you call your options broker and you say, I want to make a bet against Coca-Cola or McDonald's or Microsoft. He'll take that bet. And if the price goes down, you make money. The reason you would make that bet is because you heard on Karma Bank that there's now 30, there's millions of people who are boycotting Coca-Cola.
Right.
Because they're unhappy with the company. So the revenues are going to go down. So therefore, that bet's going to pay off. And what we tell people who are interested in fighting back against these corporations is to simply focus on the companies that are most vulnerable to a boycott. And this is where when we talk to groups like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and Amnesty International, they tend to try to fix everything at one time. You know, they have these huge agendas, these huge programs are trying to fix the whole world at once.
Right.
Instead of just saying, you know what, let's think like a manager of a money manager would think. This is what Karma Bank tries to tell activists, is to think like they do. Think like the enemy. This is the way the enemy thinks. Think like they think, and then do the thing that the last thing in the world that they would ever want you to do, which is to look at their stock price and only their stock price. And because we are educating people about this, the right-wing press in America has gone ballistic.
Uh-huh.
You've got guys now in Washington at junkscience.com who have come out and said that Karma Bank is a threat to the entire economy. And they're calling people up and they're threatening to have them fired from their jobs. I'm speaking at a conference in Germany later this week, and these guys have been calling people up on the phone in America and saying, if you let this guy speak, we're going to have you fired from your job. We're important people. We know people in Washington. And it's really because they know that what I'm saying here is the worst nightmare. If you're a company and you're committing ecological damage and you've got the masses educated about how these financial systems actually work in a way that they can participate, remember, it doesn't cost you a penny to think like this. It's just a matter of changing the way you think a little bit and to attack these companies in a way that they themselves are attacking us, and to make it a fair fight. Make it a fair fight by simply bringing to the equation some what we call monetizing your dissent, by saying, look, I have a problem with the way these companies are operating, and I'm going to put that dissent into the marketplace using this Karma Bank technique of boycotting only companies that are vulnerable. And if you do so, you will attract those money managers, those hedge fund managers who can make those big negative bets against these companies.
Uh-huh.
And they'll effectively put the companies on the defensive. And now you've got a fair fight on your hands.
Okay.
Now the company is in a position of having to either respond to the concerns of the people who are campaigning against it, Or they are going to be on the defensive.
And so give me a quick list of companies that are the ones that you don't like right now.
Okay, well, yeah, like I said, on the Karma Bank, we screen companies for the boycott vulnerability.
Uh-huh.
And as well as companies that people are taking a position against.
Right.
So number one is Coca-Cola. It's the most vulnerable with the most campaigns around the world.
Uh-huh.
Again, Karma Bank, we're simply the broker. We're saying this is a company that's got a high price-to-sales ratio, and it's got the most people around the world taking a position against it. There's a lot of people who don't like Coca-Cola for a lot of different reasons. We don't get into it. We just say it's got a high boycott vulnerability ratio. There's a lot of people who are campaigning against it, so it's got the single greatest
rating. What are they doing? Rating. What are they doing wrong? I mean, to the economy, to the world, what is it that makes them an enemy?
Well, allegedly, they're doing things like in India, they're sucking groundwater out of the ground and depriving us of farmers in India. They are they're selling products allegedly that have insecticides in these products. They are allegedly involved in labor relations in Colombia in a very nasty way. Plus, people are concerned about the company, its health profile, et cetera, et cetera. The point is that they've got millions of people around the world who have joined various campaigns against Coca-Cola. And so we take that into consideration. We say, okay, it's got by far the greatest number of people who come to the site have decided that they have a problem with Coca-Cola. Okay, fine. Is Coca-Cola vulnerable to a boycott? Yes, it is. Put those two things together, it's got the highest Karma Bank rating that we track. Fine. Uh-huh. Then after Coca-Cola comes companies in the top five, you'll find McDonald's, you'll find Exxon, you'll find Microsoft, and Ryanair, Starbucks. So these are companies that people are taking campaigns against, and they all are vulnerable to a boycott. And then those would be the top names.
And what does Starbucks do? Because I always thought they're supposed to be a happy, hippie company where they go to Grateful Dead shows or something,
Well, Starbucks is, they say that they're really supportive of what's called fair trade coffee.
Uh-huh.
But in fact, less than 2% of the coffee is fair trade coffee.
What does that mean, fair trade? I know you ordered a fair trade latte on one of your videos, but what does that mean?
Yeah. In other words, so the fair trade coffee means that the farmers who are growing these coffee beans get a living, get an amount of money for their coffee that they can live on.
Uh-huh.
And it's a program that's being picked up in different countries and supported in different countries. Starbucks has a tremendous campaign saying we support fair trade coffee. It's a lot of public relations. They're getting a lot of public relations benefit out of it. So a lot of people have some object to this because they're not really. It's more PR than substance, I would say. So there's a lot of static in the community against this.
Uh-huh.
But again, in Karma Bank, what we do is we simply present the economic metrics,
right,
and we give activists a way to band together and to, as we say, monetize their dissent. In other words, you're taking your, if you've got an issue, let's say that you've got an issue with a company. There could be a company that you have, a part of a campaign. I'm not sure if there is a company. It could be any company. The idea is you have solidarity with other people out there who are also trying to take a position against these companies. These companies effectively, they're all joined at the hip, in effect, through the global banking system.
Right.
If you have a position with a company, whatever company it is, no matter what you're talking about, they're all basically joined to this common banking system anyway. They're all fed with the same cheap money.
Is this the IMF you're talking about? Is that what you're talking about? The International Monetary? Are you talking about the International Monetary Fund? Is that what you mean?
I'm talking about the fact that most 35% of all the profits for the companies in America come from financing and banking. This is the biggest profit center for these companies in America right now. Like General Motors, for example, they make more money lending money to people to buy cars than they do making cars.
Uh-huh.
That's where they make their money. This is where most companies make their money, is in the business of lending money. Even companies that you would never imagine are in this business are using their balance sheet to leverage their balance sheet to borrow money, to lend money, because this game, this huge financing game out there, is fueling the profits of these companies. But my point is that these companies are all essentially joined in the back end through the common banking system. So when an activist takes a position against a company. Not only is it a huge company, but it's really, they're taking a position against a system that is commonly joined. So therefore, it makes sense if you're an activist to find some solidarity with other activists and say, you know what, maybe I have a problem with Chevron because Chevron is doing something bad to the ecology because it's in the oil industry.
Right.
But instead of spending the next 6 months campaigning against Chevron, I'm going to join with those campaigners out there who are campaigning against Coca-Cola for 6 months.
Right.
And I'm going to join the Coca-Cola campaign simply because I want to show the entire global corporate community that we, as an activist diaspora, have the ability to have our monetary input reflected in this economy. This is what we're saying.
So it's sort of like a clearinghouse for dissent in a way.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Exactly. You've got it.
Uh-huh. So my concern is, how do you know a company is really doing stuff that's wrong versus people say they are? You know what I mean? Like, there's obviously no sort of trial going on. How do you know that you're not causing damage to a good company? Is what I want to know.
Well, I mean, this product, this Karma Bank idea, is the product of the internet age.
Uh-huh.
It's only through the internet that we could get all this data, crunch the numbers, and put it back into the community. And the community, as you know, and the internet has a very good way of weeding out the wheat from the chaff.
Uh-huh.
You know, eBay, for example, if you're not a good seller on eBay, you get marginalized pretty quickly.
Right, right.
So the information that comes through the internet is people are the collective intelligence of the internet can look at this data and look at this information, and then they know people in the area, they talk, they communicate. So a profile emerges.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, in aggregate, the ecology is suffering woefully. It's really difficult for people to deny the fact now that the environment, the ecology, because of global warming and climate change, is really suffering. It's becoming quite clear now.
Right.
The average temperatures are moving up. The increase in hurricanes are moving up, and all the weather damage is moving up. All of these things are becoming quite clear. So people are becoming quite aware. And if you don't, all you need to do is look at what the insurance industry is saying, because the insurance industry is really the bottom line, if you will. The insurance industry is saying that climate change and global warming is making it impossible for them to underwrite insurance. For example, they're saying that it's going to be almost impossible for anyone in Florida to buy insurance because of global warming and climate change. So that's not somebody on the internet
who's
like a Chicken Little running around screaming, sure, oh, the sky is falling. It's the insurance industry, which is a fundamental part of the American economy, saying we cannot offer this service anymore to insure these people. In the UK, there are 200,000 counties that have been marked as uninsurable now due to flooding, which is a direct result of climate change and global warming. So these things are really happening. So the question then becomes, how can we stop these corporations who are primarily responsible for this?
Right.
How do we stop them?
Okay.
And the only way to stop them, as far as Karma Bank is concerned, is you've got to cut them off from their cash supply, because they feed on cash. If you cut them off from their cash supply, then they will no longer have the wherewithal to continue down this path. And the people who are the consumers, thinking in terms of a solidarity and as an aggregate, can apply this pressure in a way that the companies understand, because the companies at the end of the day look really only at one thing, and that's their stock price. They only look at that. So if you can come to them and say, look, we're organizing ourselves in such a way as to look at your stock price and how the risks of what you're doing may not be reflected, you're going to catch the attention of the trillion-dollar global hedge fund industry, who then is going to start making these negative bets, and then you've got a fair fight. So the company is then going to either change its behavior, or it's going to do some other things. But at least it's a fair fight, because right now it's not a fair fight.
Right.
They've got all the cards, and we're taking all the risk. Exxon doesn't pay hardly anything for the oil they extract. They pay hardly anything for the carbon dioxide emissions they emit.
Can you explain this?
We have to suck it down.
We're
the ones who are paying the price. We're taking the risk. Why should we take the risk?
Can you explain something to me?
Shareholders make money. It should be fair. There should be equal risk and reward.
Right.
Unless Exxon wants to give every single American a share of Exxon stock as compensation for the risk we're taking. Have they suggested that? I mean, that's what they should be doing if they were being fair.
Max,
they should give every single person a share of the stock.
Oh, so I just want to ask you while we're on the subject of Exxon, there's something I really don't understand. I think a lot of Americans don't understand this. The oil, the gas prices are, you know, of course, gone way up, but Exxon has record profits. How does that happen? I mean, is there no regulation? I just don't understand that at all.
Well, in America, there's this idea which became very popular during the Reagan years of trickle-down economics, which is that if you let the biggest and richest get bigger and richer, that some of that money is going to trickle down and we're all going to benefit. I call it the golden shower approach.
I call that aristocracy.
It's an aristocracy. So in other words, this is the mentality that's running the corporate, the Exxon. Yeah. And of course, they did a fantastic job in getting themselves into the top political office.
Yeah.
Dick Cheney obviously went right from Halliburton. Halliburton, right. All those no-bid contracts in Iraq, all those no-bid contracts in Louisiana, he went right from Halliburton right into the White House.
Right.
That's not a democracy. That's a plutocracy.
And Condoleezza, I believe, wasn't she on with one of those oil companies, too, on the board, I think?
Yeah, that's right. She served on the board. This is what happened, I think, looking back, is that if you remember back in the mid to late 90s, you had this incredible possibility for a digital revolution economically in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
But that is a very big threat if you are an entrenched monopolist like an Exxon, a Coke, or a Microsoft. You don't want all these entrepreneurs and all these dot-coms and all this new blood, and especially the spokesperson of that time, if you recall, Al Gore was very vocal about the possibilities of what the Internet could offer. And if you're in the oil business or the tobacco business or the nuclear energy business, you're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that this guy and these people don't get into power, because they're going to, in fact, you can economically introduce high-efficient cars, hybrid technology. You can do all these things if the will is there, which would totally marginalize these big oil companies.
Right.
So if you're in these oil companies, you're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that you hold on to power. So they're very, without any embarrassment whatsoever, they just basically did almost like a leverage buyout of the White House. It's like a hostile raid almost. They bring in all the bankers. It was like watching, RJR Nabisco, do a deal or something like this. It was just an unbelievable display of money seizing assets.
How did they do that? By just giving money to the presidential campaign for Bush, or how did that work? How did that happen?
Well, one of the interesting things in the stock market is a fantastic, it's a fantastic aggregator of information. For example, as Bush's candidacy, if you just looked at the tobacco stocks, you could tell that Bush was going to have a very good shot at getting into the White House, because the tobacco stocks kept going up and up and up. Because remember, under Clinton, they had a huge lawsuit come about,
right?
Which under now Bush, most of it's been reversed. But this is a lot of money that can be worked. And we know it from CommaBank. Give an example of CommaBank, for example. Now, you know that we come out with this idea that says that you can join together with other activists around the world through the Internet and push back against corporations by looking at their stock price.
Uh-huh.
There's a fund in Washington called the Free Enterprise Action Fund,
right?
Which is run by this guy Malloy and Tom Borelli.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw what we were doing, and they came out with a fund. So instead of competing fairly and saying, well, here's our fund and here's what you guys do, let's see, let the best man win, they're so embedded in the system in such a corrupt manner that they're able to, we saw it on our site. The second they became active, there was emails to the Wall Street Journal, emails to all these internet groups that do a lot of low-level digging around and poking around, a lot of emails directly to Exxon. So they've got virtually unlimited funds. Then they've got the mouthpiece of Murdoch through Fox News, because this guy runs a thing on Fox News. They're supported by Exxon. So you've got Exxon and Murdoch News, and a guy who has no shame about going on writing, hysterical writings to get people riled up, as they do in the States on issues. They just get people riled up. They don't want any healthy debate. They don't want any intellectual discourse. Everything is, completely hysterical.
Right.
Everything is a threat. Everything is terrorism now. Everything, is cause for a complete shutdown of any kind of rational debate. I mean, this is why the U.S., the educational standards in the U.S., Madge, if you read the latest reports, I think the U.S. is now number 17 out of the top 19 countries for educational standards. The U.S. in health is now 43, a list of the U.S. of various countries around the world. The quality of life in the U.S. is dropping.
Right.
Because the guys on the inside have contempt.
Well, somebody described it that I read. They described our country as a third world country with TiVos.
Well, I mean, it's when the dust settles and the bills have to get paid. The only thing keeping America alive right now is all this cheap money that America borrows from China, effectively.
How does that happen? What's the mechanism behind the China thing? Because I know that we get a lot of money from China, but I don't, when I spend money, I don't see yen or anything. I see, or what is in China? What do they call the money there? Chinese pesos?
The yuan.
Flan?
The yuan.
Oh.
The yuan or the renminbi.
Yuan?
The renminbi.
See, okay. Let's say whatever.
That's
the
Chinese currency.
But how does that?
So There's two ways it happens. First of all, you've got the situation where China sells America cheap goods, right?
Uh-huh.
So you buy your plasma screen TVs and your other plastic gizmos and gadgets.
Right.
They manufacture in China. The average wage in China is about roughly $100 a month. That's what the average Chinese, and that's up from $30 a month. So their wages are improving over there in China.
Right.
But it obviously it's a lot less than what people would be paid in America. So they make this stuff over there. It's incredibly cheap. Some people say it's slave labor. I'm not sure. You can't say it isn't slave labor. It pretty well is slave labor. But they make these products. It goes to America. America gives dollars to China. So China now has a lot of dollars in exchange for the goods that they've sold into the American economy. What China does with those dollars is that they use the dollars that America's given them to buy U.S. Treasury government bonds.
Why do they do that?
To protect the value of those dollars. Because, you see, if in fact they kept debasing the wage structure, then the value of the dollar would collapse because they're basically hollowing out the economy. So unless they keep the dollar supported by buying the dollars themselves, then the value of their dollars would go down.
Now, who's
financing?
Who's actually buying these bonds then? Is it
the
government?
The Bank of China.
The bank, okay.
And the Bank of Japan.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So they're buying to support because the economy is being hollowed out.
Mm-hmm.
But before it collapses, they want to make sure that they own as much as they possibly can. Because another way that this happens is, like, for example, when you take a mortgage out from Citigroup or some other bank for your house, Citigroup doesn't keep their mortgage on their books. They sell it to another bank.
Right.
And they eventually sell it to China. China is the biggest buyer of this paper. So effectively, when people are going to default on their mortgages in the United States, this whole new law that came into effect in October where people can't declare bankruptcy in the same way that they could.
Right.
And interest rates are still going up. And people can't pay their mortgages anymore. What they're going to find out is that they owe the money to some Chinese bank. Of course, China is not a democracy. China is still a communist country. And if you default on your debt in China, they kill you. They do state-sanctioned, the state kills you.
No.
If you don't pay back your debt.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It's a communist country. It hasn't changed from, remember we were talking about the Red Menace not too long ago, that there was a domino theory in Asia and Southeast Asia and the U.S. wanted to fight it all. Well, they're still there. They've gone from forced labor to forced consumption, but that's another story. But nevertheless, all that paper is being is owned basically by these Chinese banks. So you effectively own the paper that you owe the bank. The bank has already sold it off, and a lot of it ends up in China. So China ends up being the creditor. China is the creditor of the world, and America is the consumer of the world. These two are in this very strange global embrace of, and the U.S., unfortunately, is in a weaker position once this thing starts to come unglued, and that's the China story.
Hmm.
I mean, I don't want to go on too many tangents, but I mean...
That's interesting for me. That's interesting. But, so should I move back to Europe? That's what I'm thinking. Of course, it comes back to me, you know, being an insular American. I'm trying to think, Jesus, I got to get the hell out. Oy vey. Did you hear?
Well, the Americans, what we talk about on our show a lot is, I mean, at least be aware of what's really going on.
Right.
Because it doesn't make any sense to be in a kind of a bubble and to buy into this whole nonsense that there aren't some alternative visions of how economies should work, and there are a lot of different ways you can work an economy. The U.S. model, it's a so-called neoliberal model, the Washington consensus. It's a model that's broken because it generates more garbage than it does growth. There's just too much garbage being generated. The U.S. creates 27% of the world's garbage. I mean, it just creates too much garbage. When the U.S. comes out and says we're growing at 3% a year or 3.5% a year, well, if you factor in the cost of cleaning up the garbage, it eats up more than that 3.5%. It's actually negative. It's like a big ant farm. You know, the ant farm, you don't clean it out often enough, it just soils itself, and they can't live anymore. This is, the U.S. is doing this to itself. The amount of environmental degradation going on there is stunning. Listen to this statistic, Madge.
Uh-huh.
25% of all the air pollution in Los Angeles now comes from China. Were you aware of that?
What percent?
25%.
Really? Oh.
Yeah. Blows over the Pacific.
Hmm.
Now, the only reason the Chinese can be operating at that rate of growth is because the U.S. keeps buying all that Chinese stuff.
Uh-huh.
So the U.S. is, in effect, killing itself. It's suicide consumption. You think you're tough. You know, you got your plasma screen TV, you got all your gizmos, and you're feeling great. But you're feeding an economy in China that's got zero environmental protection. And now 25% of the pollution in Los Angeles is coming from China. And that number is going up quite dramatically. Now, who's going to stop that? Are we going to tell China to stop polluting? Because China will say, you know what? Fuck you.
Stop buying our
sell our U.S. government bonds. Yeah. Now interest rates in America are 17%. Do you like that on your mortgage every month? Oh, you can't afford it? Okay, we own it now. Now you work for us. You know, Warren Buffett, who's a very well-respected guy in America, has said two things. Number one, America is becoming a nation of sharecroppers. And number two, he thinks that within 5 years, Americans are going to be paying a tax to Uncle Sam and to China.
What?
That's correct.
How can
that's coming from Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is one of the sanest guys in the world. He's the second richest guy in the world.
How can you?
He says America's becoming a nation of sharecroppers. They're indentured servants. People are on debt. They've got student debts. They've got mortgages. They pay these credit cards to buy their you know, groceries at Albertson's grocery store. You know, it's debt. But they don't own the debt. China owns the debt. Who's going to come collecting on that debt? Just jump down, turn around, pick a bale of cotton for all y'all Americans.
Right.
Because you don't have financial independence anymore. You've lost your independence. I mean, I'm American too, but I mean, living outside of the United States, you see things from a slightly different perspective. And should you move out of the United States? I mean, at least become aware of what's going on. The economy in the United States is being sold down the river. You're being sold down. You're being sold off to China. You're being sold off. You know. So what are you going to do about it? I mean, there are things you can do about it.
So Karma Bank actually can. Yeah. Do you have any examples of how this has worked? I mean, has this actually had an impact on companies? Do you have examples?
No. Not really, because the numbers need to get higher. I mean, I know that leading into the invasion of Iraq, you had some boycotts in around Germany.
Yeah.
And of Coca-Cola. And then they came out and they said, you know what, we missed our earnings by a penny, and the stock dropped by $6 billion. And that was an indication of the kind of the numbers that we're talking about. But no company has yet come out and really, you know, the proof is in the company. The company has got to come out and say Karma Bank is a factor in this quarter's numbers. Has that happened? No. Is there something out there? Is there a groundswell of activity around the world on the web, on the internet, in the chat rooms, on the blogs? It's growing because people, for the reasons that we've said. So I think it's a growing.
So what are the action?
Stacy now.
What are the Stacy, action I'm points? What
are referring with Stacy because she's the master keeper of all the vital statistics. The question is an example. Yeah, weren't we just talking about something the couple weeks ago of a. We've had some. Yeah, we're working on it. I mean, it's the people. You see, the problem is people are very. They don't want to. You have to really come to terms with the fact that there is this really bad problem. Mm-hmm. First of all, and people don't want to really say. This is the problem. Most of the people think that if they give a few bucks to Friends of the Earth, or they buy, you know, a few cups of fair trade coffee. This is where Starbucks has made a lot of mileage on this. Uh-huh. That they've done their thing. They've done their bit. They've contributed to how this is all going to work out in a better way. But the problem is really systematic. It's a lot bigger than people want to really admit because, first of all, they're being told that the biggest problem in the world is terrorism, so-called terrorism, from these, you know, bad guys.
Right. So
but this is not really the biggest problem. This is a problem, yes, of course, it's a problem, but it's not a new problem. It's a problem, yes. Is it the biggest problem? Well,
no way.
Yeah, my thinking is that the rate at which the environment is degrading. It's degrading faster. It's the biggest problem, and that's our position at Karma Bank. We say, look, the environment is really the biggest issue that we need to focus on right now, and the corporations are not incentivized to do anything about it because it's not in their charter to take into consideration the environment. They're simply there to make money for their shareholders. Okay, that's fine. But let's not waste time trying to get corporations to act like better corporate citizens. They never will do it.
You know, you're absolutely right, because if you tie, because corporations are, I actually went to a business.
Bonjour, vous êtes sur la messagerie France Télécom du 0144.
Oh, now he's calling.
Votre correspondant est déjà en ligne. Veuillez laisser un message.
Somebody's calling my cellular. This is getting too much now. Maybe I'll edit some of this shit out. This is ridiculous. I shouldn't do this. People from the radio, I should give better. Let's try this bonjour shit again. Don't give me that bonjour.
Hello.
Listen, I got a recording. It said bonjour and all this shit. How am I supposed to speak French? Doesn't that recording know I'm not in France?
Everyone should be able to speak French.
Well, listen, you know, this is America. We're not allowed to say France. I think I get to go to Guantanamo now because of you and that lady.
French is the language of diplomacy. French is the language of love. If America spoke more French, they wouldn't find themselves in the problems that they find themselves in.
So?
The American language is very. You know what Charles V said? He said that he spoke French to his mistress, he spoke German to his dog, and he spoke English and American to his horse.
I heard the same joke when I lived in Holland, but it was that he spoke Dutch to his horse. Just insert Germanic language here, I guess.
Yes. Well, anyway, I mean.
Right. So I'm recording the show now, and here's how it works. What recording is, I've had a massively fucked up show, but I don't have time to redo it, so we're just going to deal with it. I had took a huge dump this morning. I shat probably 20 pounds of bloat, and then...
Oh, that's fantastic.
And then my dog
shit. Fantastic news. We all rejoice.
Now, how does this figure into your economic world? Do you have to get out your visor with the green tint and then take a pencil and figure some shit out and tell me how this affects... Karma?
No, you're purging yourself of all of your misperceptions and preconceptions that you no longer need.
Okay, so but I can get biodiesel out of that or something and affect.
You could sell it to some biodiesel gas stations perhaps, and they could convert that into some kind of energy producing substance, I would imagine.
Oh, sounds wonderful. So here's how it works. So I'm 13 minutes into the show. I got to fill 23 minutes for Sirius, and then I go, which means about 10 more minutes, and then I'm gonna. Then we can keep talking, and that'll just stay on Yeast Radio for the rest of it. So I'll tell you when I have to. I'll do like some nice little wrap up, and then we'll just keep talking after that if you want.
Yeah. Okay. So, fine.
So you are the co-host, right, of Karma Bank, you and Stacy. And you,
that's right. And Stacy and I co-host the Karma Bank Radio Blogspot.
Can you explain what it is? Because I sure as hell can't. But I, please do.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, there's four basic, I guess, steps, if you will. I mean, the first thing to consider is that we are working, in effect, or Karma Bank is working for the ecology. You know, we take the position that the ecology is our client, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
Then the next thing we consider is that the ecological problems that are developing are caused by corporations for the most part, and that corporations survive on their cash flow.
Uh-huh.
So the question is, how can you cut the corporations off from their cash flow, and in so doing, cut down their ability to destroy the environment? And the Karma Bank has figured out a way to do this that doesn't cost anybody any money. And on the show, we talk about economic issues, and we talk about these corporations, and we talk about the damage that's being done. But we also try to get to as many people as possible who can participate in this Karma Bank methodology, which doesn't require any money whatsoever, but is a way to deprive these corporations of their vital cash flow and thus take away their ability to destroy the environment, which is, per Sir David King, the science advisor in the UK, Tony Blair's chief science advisor, the biggest problem, the biggest threat in the world today, much, much more of a threat than any so-called terrorist threat, according to Sir David King, is the environmental threat.
Well,
and so
I think even the Pentagon has said the same thing, I believe, right?
That's right. The Pentagon has also said that as well. So, this is a way to address this problem that is, I think, it uses kind of banking techniques in a way that have never been used before, and it takes advantage of a couple of quirks in the system.
Okay.
That can be exploited by the average listener to your show or our show to, in effect, empower themselves, or what we like to say, it's a way to monetize your dissent, to put it in economic terms.
How do you do that?
Okay. Well, the way it works is that we have figured out that different corporations have a different vulnerability to the free voice of dissent, the choice, the free, low-cost activist method, which is the boycott. The boycott effectively doesn't cost you anything.
Right, right.
But the boycott needs to be brought into the 21st century. So what we did was we look at all these different companies and we figure out which company is actually the most impacted by a boycott. And by this we mean the stock price itself. If it's trading at a very high multiple to the amount of business that the company does, then if you were to boycott that particular company, you're having a greater impact on that company than if you were to choose a company that has a lower ratio.
And how do you find out which stock prices are most in line with consumer demand? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, we take the data, which is the price over sales ratio, which is available, easily gotten.
Uh-huh.
But the idea is if you get enough people to think in this manner, see, it's a two-tier process. If you get enough people to think in this way, that they're going to boycott strategically, what we're hoping to do is to create a situation which I guess you could call hedge fund bait. Okay? Now, hopefully we can get through all these terms, but this is nevertheless...
You lost me there. You want me to masturbate?
No. This is hedge fund bait.
Okay.
Which is, in other words, a hedge fund is a fund that's very, they're mercenaries.
Uh-huh.
They're mercenaries in the market, and they look for anything, any way to make a dollar, they'll do it. They have no allegiance to any company, any country, or anyone. They're not regulated, really, in any way.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's probably a bit of a problem,
uh-huh.
But for the purposes of getting, you can get these hedge funds effectively if you come to them with the right kind of boycott or bait. They will attack the stock of these companies for you. They will attack the company's stock for you by making all of these negative bets on a company's stock, because they know that you're boycotting the company, you're depriving the company of its revenues, and therefore they will go ahead and start making negative bets against the company, attacking the company's stock effectively.
Oh, I see. So it's more than it's more than just a PR thing. This is actually affecting the companies. This is actually affecting the economics of the companies that do environmental damage. Is that right?
It's part of the financial system. You're putting everyone who's concerned about the environment, you're uh-huh. putting their concern into the economy.
Now, how does this hedge fund, I don't understand how a hedge fund, I mean, I understand what you're saying it does, but how does it work? Like, how do you make a bet against a company? I mean, are there, I didn't realize you could do that. I mean, it sounds like a racetrack. I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, there's two ways you can do it. One way is you buy what's an option, a put option.
Uh-huh.
It's an option contract. It is like a bet. It's like you're going into the casino. You know, the Globe is one big, huge financial casino, and people are making bets all day long in
right.
one way or another, and you can make a bet on the stock going down. So you make you buy a put option, and if the stock price goes down, the value of your option goes up.
Uh-huh.
So this is just like you were betting against a sports bet, and you were betting against the team winning. You can make those types of bets. I mean, Chicago, right? The White Sox just won the World Series, right?
Right.
Now, there are people who are betting against the White Sox.
Yeah.
Now, they call their bookie,
yeah.
and they say, we're going to bet against the White Sox. Now, those people lost their money because the White Sox won. Now, but they could, if the White Sox had lost, they would have made their money. Same thing with financial markets. You can make a bet that Coca-Cola stock is going to go down. You call your bookie, or in this case, your broker, and you make that bet. You say, I want to make a bet that Coke stock's going to go down. Your bookie slash broker accepts that bet. And, of course, Chicago is the world center for the options market. You know, the Chicago Board of Options Exchange is the
right.
biggest options exchange in the world. So you call your options broker and you say, I want to make a bet against Coca-Cola or McDonald's or Microsoft. He'll take that bet. And if the price goes down, you make money. The reason you would make that bet is because you heard on Karma Bank that there's now there's millions of people who are boycotting Coca-Cola
right.
because they're unhappy with the company. So the revenues are going to go down. So therefore, that bet's going to pay off. And what we tell people who are interested in fighting back against these corporations is to simply focus on the companies that are most vulnerable to a boycott. And this is where when we talk to groups like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and Amnesty International, they tend to try to fix everything at one time. You know, they have these huge agendas, these huge programs are trying to fix the whole world at once.
Right.
Instead of just saying, you know what, let's think like a manager of a money manager would think. This is what Karma Bank tries to tell activists, is to think like they do. Think like the enemy. This is the way the enemy thinks. Think like they think, and then do the thing that the last thing in the world that they would ever want you to do, which is to look at their stock price and only their stock price. And because we are educating people about this, the right-wing press in America has gone ballistic.
Uh-huh.
You've got guys... Now,
you can call me Mrs. Nibbles.
Miss Nelson?
Nibbles.
Nibbles, okay, Miss Nibbles. Grandmother, Nibbles. Miss Nibbles. Miss Nibbles. Miss Nibbles.
Okay.
All right, Miss Nibbles. Grandmother. Miss
Miss Nibbles. Miss Nibbles.
Miss Nibbles. Miss Nibbles, what are you doing? No, Grandma, Miss Nibbles, please don't be tasing her. And Miss Nibbles, please, you're really abusing her. Well, Grandmother, what are you doing? Miss Nibbles, what are you doing to her?
Miss Nibbles, my name is Miss Nibbles.
Lord, Grandma. Miss Neville, please stop shooting.
Now
take the gun out of there, Miss Neville, please. Miss Neville, I will fuck you. Now take the gun out of her pussy.
Don't point that gun at me, Miss Naples. Put that gun down.
Buckle up, buckaroo.
Now listen here, my friends. Can I have your attention, please? It's time you people contemplate the Democrats of 88. Why, if you do, you'll feel something akin to the great thrill I once enjoyed when Harold Stassen, General Custer, Fritz Mondale, the entire Chicago Cubs, and George S. McGovern all came to town on the very same historic day. 76 unknowns are the candidates, 110 more soon will declare. On Capitol Hill you'll find not a member left behind except for Ted, who hasn't got a prayer.
76 unknowns landed in Des Moines, 110 more went to Dubuque. They're learning to pull up while they are kissing every cow.
Whoever wins will get there by a fluke.
The reporters all are checking out their resumes. Catch a lie, make him cry, push him out the door. Have you heard how Jackson has been making out?
Stake him out!
Who is he taking out?
2,000 special interests, they are pandering, posturing, promising
peace instead of war.
What Babbitt says, nobody hears, though Simon has enormous ears. And
who knows what Gore is running for? 76 have shown they're above reproach, so they all would shun Donna Rice.
By the time they're done, they will swear they date a nun.
They have to win if they should sin.
There is no hope,
no smoke and dope.
They have to get endorsements from the Pope.
Don't bring me flowers.
You don't bring me blueprints.
You don't hold my hand anymore, 'cause I'm not standing guard at the embassy door.
We remember when
I couldn't wait to hug you.
I couldn't wait to bug you in your decoding room late at night,
out of sight of my boss
and your spy satellite. Did you know what went on
when we turned out the light?
You don't bring me secrets anymore.
You would give my passkey to your Uncle Spassky.
Then he and the KGB'd walk through the door. Now I can't break your cablegram codes anymore.
Baby, I remember all the things you gave me.
You gave me the maps where your submarines crawl.
And you gave me an embassy 10 stories tall with a listening device built inside every wall.
You don't like my built-ink anymore.
Now you know how my big guided cruise missile flies.
Yes, I know where your sweet little midget man lies.
Where are all our rockets?
Let me check your pockets.
That is what a few good men are for.
Mm-hmm.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our exclusive coverage of day 29 of the Contragate hearings. The throats were full of thunder in the hearing room that day as C-SPAN aired it coast to coast and did the play-by-play. Each witness tried to pass the buck about who passed the hat. They all said it was Casey, mighty Casey, who did that. Bill Casey used to go to bat when Contras needed guns, but Congress threw them hard and high and struck out all their funds. Then Casey told the Contras how to get an extra base. He said, "We'll send you money through accounts they'll never trace." First off, he raised the ticket price for all the right-wing nuts through letters with the autograph of Ollie, Blood and Guts, inviting them to meet the boss on special White House tours for folks with dough like Ross Perot and Mr. Adolf Kurz. He sent McFarland to Iran, a mighty big mistake, but looked real hard for moderates. He really took the cake. They even brought a Bible for the Ayatollah's son. Who first proposed this clever plan? They called him Country One. They love to use this secret name, a CIA device. This Country One, that's Israel, got twice the retail price. But Casey wouldn't tell them where he got his revenue. He got it from their enemy. He called them Country Two. The Saudis thought he needed cash to fight guerrilla fires, but Ali bought some pantyhose and brand new winter tires. $10 million had vanished. Now, could something be amiss? You better have your numbers straight when dealing with the Swiss. The guy who got the missing millions wondered who to thank. Those extra dollars helped him win a toaster from his bank. Back in Iran, some middleman told all to Al-Shara, while here at home, Fawn Hall put extra shredding in her bra. Both Ollie and Poindexter claimed their Fifth Amendment rights. They like to play in darkness. Congress said, "Turn on the lights." The first on base was Secord in this error-ridden game. Then Bud McFarland sacrificed. He said he'd take the blame. The senators and congressmen were swinging heavy bats. Election year is coming, and you know those Democrats. And now a witness drops a name, and now they let him go. And now the public wonders just what did each person know? Oh, someday in some hearing room, will some deep throat come clean? Will someone name some names just like some latter-day John Dean? If Congress finds one witness who can end all further doubt, then they just can't blame poor Casey. Mighty Reagan could strike out.
Now can you picture where famous people go to prison? It's a tennis and a racquetball lodge. Now imagine arriving is a fella named Ivan. Mr. Bosky's in for arbitrage. A prison job they let him choose. The warden said, "Have you got a skill you can use?" They're talking to the clever and conniving, high-fiving Ivan with an offer that he can't refuse. Now, as a federal inmate, Mr. Ivan Bosky ain't what the guards have usually seen. He's got a portable phone, he's got a secretary. Hey, honey, get me Dennis Levine. He's got a big red button to call E.F. Hutton and a blue one for the Wall Street News. That man, he is a thrifty and a thriving, high-fiving Ivan with the hoochie-coochie-goochie shoes. To put a man of Ivan's expertise in charge of laundry was a big mistake. With all the sheets he absconds, he launders money with bonds. He's got a corner on detergent flakes. Because the SEC is letting Ivan be with just $100 million fine. He's dropped a name or two, and now he's fingered you. You're gonna join him in the prison line. So baby, don't get too fond of all your stocks and your bonds. You better cancel that Pacific cruise. Because I hear the big boss is cutting his losses, and you're the one he did accuse. So when Ivan's done serenading,
have to zig and zag. Anchor, we'll escort you with our flag. We spent a lot of chips on a lot of battleships. Where the oil drips, we'll light a rag. Here I've laid some mines around the strait. We've gone there to tempt a little fate. Mr. Senator, this is what a navy's for. Time to risk a war to help Kuwait. Kuwaitis, let's help the Kuwaitis. If someone attacks them from Iran, come on, Congress, they cut a foil to Japan. Khomeini is crazy. He'll attack Kuwait just like Iraq. Congress, don't be cowards. Would you rather have old Carter back?
And so productive, the guy from Mitsubishi goes hawking, and as I'm buying, I hear him sighing.
Ah, so though you made the first computer, I soon became your substitute.
To each invention, I hear him mention.
Ah, so. When the people go by a TV, they look straight at me, not GE.
Pretty soon you will be seeing me trading your stuff for Korean. I'll kiss my Honda goodbye. It's Hyundai for me.
Oh no!
That's how it will be.
They pay less than me.
Ah, so.
Did you enjoy that last song? Did you? Thank you. Thank you. Well, my name is Joe Biden, and I wrote it. As a kid, I told my mom that Mother Goose rhymes were written in a crib by me. For all the quotes I used in school, I had an attribution rule. I put a footnote at the bottom, except when I forgot them. I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a lecture and make believe it came from me. I'm gonna quote from near and far, JFK and FDR. If you do research, you'll find I stole from Churchill. Then one day I got caught by Mike Dukakis, who ripped my whole campaign apart. I told them all I blew it, and I'm quitting. It's a line I got. It isn't mine. It's not. It's a line I got from Gary Hart.
Thank you. distance. Long distance, get me heaven. Oh, heaven, hold for Pat Robertson.
Amen.
Operator,
the information is the preacher.
It's the preacher on the line.
I need a holy,
commendation
from that great almighty man divine. I've been brushing up my resume. I made a couple changes in my wedding days. He's supporting my nomination. Get the Father on the line. Operator, information.
There's a problem with the line.
The man in heaven has call waiting.
And God is on the other line.
God, I really need to talk to you. I'm trying to avoid the 60-minute screw. Tell Mr. Koppel, I am forgiven by the almighty may and divine.
Mr. Preacher, congratulations, almighty mother.
Because it makes me feel like a fucking slut whore bitch.